Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today is an episode in the replay series in which we revisit episodes for those new to the podcast. Today we're revisiting the episode I did with California lawyer Raymond Heckmap. It's actually one of the most popular episodes ever in the podcast series, and it initially aired on the 23rd of July 2023. So here we go, my discussion with Raymond Heckmap. Welcome to the podcast. Raymond Heckmap is a lawyer and founder of Heckmap Law and Mediation, APC, based in Beverly Hills. They focus on family law with areas including divorce, paternity, custody, and support issues, as well as prenuptial agreements. Raymond earned his Juris Doctorate degree from Loyola Law School in 2009. During his tenure at Loyola, Raymond was president of the Evening Bar Association and was awarded the Alumni Association Governor's Alumni Award. While earning his degree, Raymond worked as a law clerk and later as an associate for a Beverly Hills family law firm. Later, Raymond was an associate with the offices of Shulman and Alden in Century City, where he managed his own complex family law caseload as well as providing assistance to the partners in family law litigation. He's admitted to practice law in California and is a member of the Los Angeles County and Beverly Hills Bar Associations. Raymond received his Bachelor of Arts degree in International Studies with honours and a minor in Business Management from the University of California at Irvine, with a study at the London School of Economics in London, England. He was also a member of the Division 1 UCI men's tennis team and continues to play competitive tennis as a member of the USTA. Raymond was born and raised in Los Angeles and lives in West Los Angeles with his wife and two sons. Hi Raymond, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
You practice in California. Can you tell us if your practice covers the whole spectrum of marriage and divorce and prenups, etc., or does it have one particular focus?
Yeah, so I started my career as a family law attorney where my practice was mostly in litigation and fighting over divorces, people getting divorced, going to court, fighting over issues. And through that process, I learned a lot about the court system, about people going through divorces, and myself. And I realized that there were better ways of going about it, and there are better ways of getting divorced and helping people through that process without creating the collateral damage of litigation. And so my practice has kind of converted into more of a consulting practice where I help people through the mediation process in resolving issues amicably and efficiently, where people can work together and become better co-parents for their children and moving on with their lives without creating that damage and the impact that divorce has on families in general. So my practice is a lot of divorce consulting, divorce mediation, as well as prenuptial and postnuptial agreements for people getting married or entering into agreements during marriage.
That's really interesting. One of our previous guests, he was a psychotherapist in an Arizona family court. When we spoke to him, he just retired, I think, or a few years earlier. But he had about 20 years experience in the family courts in Arizona. He mentioned that some parts of the states are moving to a more collaborative form of law, less adversarial. That sounds as if it's similar to your approach. Is there a formal collaborative movement happening in California, or is that just an approach that
you've come to through your earlier experiences?
So I wouldn't say that it's formal, but there are groups of collaborative lawyers that join groups with other collaborative attorneys and collaborative accountants that all work together on certain cases. And there's a whole area of law called collaborative law that people say they practice collaborative law. I don't practice in collaborative law. It's a little different. it may not sound very different, but at the end of the day, what collaborative law is, at least here in California, is where you have two parties and each of them has an attorney that is a collaborative attorney. And the two attorneys will work together with other professionals, and everyone is really working together to move the process along. And a lot of times there creates a conflict of interest, because at the end of the day, you still need to represent your client. You need to still not be adversarial, but advocate. And a lot of times that collaborative process takes that away. I believe that there are ways to advocate, but at the same time, mediate and move forward and come to agreements that work for everyone. Well, the thing with collaborative law is sometimes it's too many cooks in the kitchen. There's a lot of people involved, and it sometimes gets more expensive than it needs to be. And that was a big reason why I decided to move into the area that I am now, because I just believed as a family law attorney, there's an inherent conflict of interest. Because at the end of the day, the more adversarial you are, the more fights you create as an attorney, the more money you make.
Yeah.
And so I believe that there was just a conflict there. As an attorney, you want to help someone, but you don't want to help them too much, because if you help them too much, you don't make the money. And there was a conflict there that I just wasn't allowing me to do the job that I want to do for my clients.
Yeah. I think the more problems there are in a case, the more money is made. And I think that's, I think I've had experience of that.
Unfortunately. And you know, in terms of the formalization, they're like, the courts now have seen the benefits of mediation, have seen the benefits of collaborating and coming to agreements and easing the tension on the courthouse and the judges, and the number of cases are heard. Because right now, if you file a motion in the Los Angeles courthouse, you're not going to get a hearing date for maybe 3 to 4 months out. And obviously there are emergency situations, but for the most part, you're not going to be heard for at least 4 months. And that's a long time, especially when you have kids with pressing issues. So these days, and it's been like this for a long time now, when you file a motion with the courthouse, especially when it's dealing with custody issues, there is a mandatory mediation that the court puts in place, that before the court hears your case on whatever issues of custody or visitation you're dealing with, you're actually mandated to go to a mediator provided by the courthouse, and you try to work it out before you let the judge decide. And that has alleviated some of it as well. And there's also daily settlement officers for all other issues, and there's a lot of sources through the court in order to try to resolve and settle on issues rather than having a judge decide.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Did you just mentioned, was it daily settlement officers?
So aside from the mandated mediation, which is through the courthouse, the bar associations here provide daily settlement officers to the courthouse, which are generally volunteer family law attorneys that go to the court. They're scheduled to be at the courthouse on that day. And the day of the hearing, a judge may send your case, down to the settlement officer before they decide, because they think, I don't need to decide this. You guys can probably figure this out on your own with a mediator. How about you go downstairs, talk to that mediator, see if you can work it out, and if you can't, come back up. And so that's been a really great resource for a lot of parties and attorneys, again, to alleviate the judge's workload and to come up with better decisions. Because through mediation, through settlement, you can get a lot more creative with your agreement than a judge would. Yes. Judges are a lot of times very black and white. Yes. But if you and your partner work together, you can come up with creative solutions that a judge may not think of, maybe because they don't have time, or they don't know your children. They don't know who you are. They don't know what your family is like. They're just looking at numbers, and they're looking at declarations that are filled with probably a bunch of lies, and they're just going to make a decision. But you and your partner are the only people that know your children, that know your family, that know your finances, that know have an understanding of what the true needs are. And you can come up with those creative solutions. And I find that that's where mediation thrives.
Yeah. That's really interesting that California has mandatory mediation. The UK, they've recently, the Ministry of Justice here has floated an idea that they are thinking about that. They've said they're thinking about it. But at the moment, it's only a recommendation. And in my own case, you know, you have to try mediation before it can go to the court. But there's a 2-week window for an invitation to be in place. And in my case, the other parent just didn't want to go. And that never happened. It's widely felt in this country, you know, that that's why they offer it in the first instance, or they say you have to offer it before court, is because it's felt to be a good option. But there's nothing to stop one of the other parties saying, no, I don't want to do it.
And look, there's a lot of times where a party doesn't want to do it, but it's mandated. So they may show up and just say, I have nothing that I want to agree to. And then right. The mediator checks a box and you're done, because it is a voluntary process. It does require two people to sit down and really look at the issues and have conversations and work through it. So if one person just doesn't want to do it, nobody can force someone to do it, but you at least have to show up for the meeting or show up for the phone call and say your piece.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, I had a 4-year case, and
wow,
after 2 years, the other party, at the recommendation of the court, finally did go for one mediation session, after which they refused to allow the mediator's report to be shown to anybody, including the judge. And all the other professionals, they just said, no, that can't be shown to anyone. Is that possible in California, or do the mediators have to report directly to the judge or the court?
No. So in California, mediations are confidential, and what is said in those meetings remains confidential 90% of the time, because there are things that need to be said and shared within mediation to come up with those solutions that you want the benefit of people being able to speak openly and honestly to come up with these solutions, so that, and if they don't have the ability to do that, the mediator can't help and the people can't come up with those solutions. But there are things in regard to custody proceedings where there might be. So we do custody evaluations. You have custody evaluators that do full reports, and they take months to do with a private professional. They cost $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to get done, and they're very invasive. But those people will report to the court as they report their opinion, and they're put on to testify, and depending on what the report says, one side says they're terrible, the other side says they're great. But then the court has its own minimum custody evaluations, where there is someone in the courthouse that may meet with the child, meet with the parents, and do a very low scale evaluation. And that person can offer their opinion to the court as well. It's not really mediation, it's more of an evaluation. And that person will talk to the judge about what they believe. We also have here in California, if you're age of 13 or over, anywhere near that, the court will hear the child's perspective and will want to hear from the child to see what they prefer in regard to custody or visitation schedules. Even under 13, I've done declarations for 8 or 9 year olds that just want the judge to hear what they have to say. And sometimes the judge will accept it, sometimes they don't. But children sometimes want to have a say or want to feel like they're being heard at some point.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned the two types of custody evaluators, and you mentioned one was very expensive and then there was a minimum one. Is it the case that the expensive one is something that one or both parties would fund?
Yeah, generally it's the cost is shared by both parents.
Yeah. Okay, so that's an expensive business. That's
it is. It's an expensive business, and it takes a big toll on everyone because you have this person coming into your home, meeting with your kids on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
You're really getting the children involved to the point where they have a stranger in their house talking to them, and they're wondering who this person is and why are they asking me these kinds of questions. And you talk to collaterals, so now you're talking to other family members and friends and coworkers and employers, and it's a very, very intrusive process.
Yeah, wow.
But those usually are the case where, sorry to interrupt, but they're usually in the case of high conflict custody proceedings, that's where those go into.
Yeah, yeah. And I hear that some of the states in America are moving or have moved to a presumption of 50-50 shared care. Is that something that's in place in California or is possible in the future?
Yeah, no, it is. So the law does provide that both parties are on equal footing. If they're getting divorced as parents, everyone has exactly the same rights. So the default is going to be joint legal, joint physical custody. It really takes a showing from one party or the other to decide or to make a showing that one side shouldn't have decision-making power or shouldn't have joint physical custody. But the default is that everyone is in the same place. And you know what? I've had clients that say, well, while we were married, I was the primary caretaker. I took care of the kids all the time. He didn't do anything. Why does he want the kids half the time now? Like, but as a father, you're entitled to that time with your children post separation. And you're a father just as much as that person is a mother. And a lot of times it's, well, you just have to wait and see how it is, how it works out. And if it's not working out, then you go back to court and ask for a change. But generally you start out with equal footing and everyone works out a schedule that works for the children. And you see how it goes. And they're always ever changing. Circumstances change, kids' needs change, parents' schedule change, and they're always modifiable. But we always start out with equal footing, as much as one party may not want to.
I mean, that sounds a great starting point. I wish we had that here. That really does sound pretty enlightened. Now, to go back to mediation, you mentioned how important it is, how valuable it can be in coming to a solution. I assume, though, that it's obvious. So it needs two willing parties to do this. And you mentioned, you know, if one turns up and just says, I don't want to do this, ticks a box and goes home, that's it done. Do you think mediation can ever work if one party is, say, alienating or aggressive or wants or feels entitled to more than the other? Or have you seen cases like that where it started out that way and a little bit of mediation has actually brought it round to a more collaborative outcome for the two parties?
You know, I have to be honest, when cases are that adversarial or you have someone with a very strong opinion in one way, it's very difficult to resolve things through mediation. Because as you said, it does take two people to be on the same page and to be able to communicate with each other. Now, a lot of times in our mediations, what we do is we have people in different rooms, and to kind of minimize that conflict, and the mediator will go room to room to have those conversations. But even then, if somebody is not willing to compromise, if it's not willing to understand where the other person is coming from, it's very much of a dead end. At that point, then you're just going to go to a judge. And as my old boss said, you're going to go to a stranger in a black muumuu and have that person decide what the rest of your life and your children's life is going to look like. Sometimes mediation works where somebody may realize that that might be the outcome, or I've had times where somebody is really strong in their opinion, but they hear from me basically voicing what their attorney has continuously told them and they chose not to listen to it, where you tell them, look, like, I'm just, my third party outside view of this is your position is kind of unreasonable. If you were going to go to court, you're not going to get that. You're better off working together and getting some of what you want, maybe. If not, you're not going to get any of it, and you might end up with a worse result if you go to court. And I got to say, the smart ones listen to that, and they turn around. But it's not that often, unfortunately. It's not that often.
Yeah. I mean, in this country, UK, there's almost a playbook that parents who want to be aggressive can use, you know, for example, making a false allegation to get legal aid, or just taking the children or stopping the other parent seeing a child, because obviously you mentioned court delays, you know, you then get a status quo built up where, you know, you might not get to court for 3-4 months, and then you might have to wait another 6 months for a hearing. So by that time, the parent who's been excluded may not have seen their child, or rarely, for almost a year. And there's various other things that can be done here to play the system. Are things like that possible in California, or are they better organized on that front?
Unfortunately, it is possible. There's a lot of people that use that playbook to make false allegations of certain kinds of abuse in order to achieve their very selfish goals. And it does come into play, unfortunately. And there are ways of working with it, but it makes the process much more difficult. It impacts the children in a lot of ways, obviously, that is not beneficial to them. I've had many, many cases where there's been false allegations of sexual abuse against the children, domestic violence abuse against the partner, things like that, that really set the tone for the entire case. And it's really hard to recover from something like that. And it really sets the trajectory of the case in the wrong direction. Now, obviously, there are many, many times where these allegations are true and they need to be implemented for the protection of the spouse or the children. But unfortunately, there are a lot of attorneys that abuse that process and are okay making these false allegations just to gain a benefit or an advantage in the case before it starts proceeding.
Yes. Yes, it's a shame to hear that. I mean, in this country as well, false allegations, even when they're proven to be false in the family courts here, at least, are not taken very seriously. The person who's lied to the court, you know, there's nothing much done, you know. It's almost seen as part of the game. Is that similar in California? You know, once somebody's been found to have lied to police or a judge, or they just sort of say, well, let's move on, or are there consequences?
You know, unfortunately, there are no, I wouldn't say there are consequences. Obviously, if somebody keeps showing up in court with the same judge, and they keep lying and they keep lying, their credibility is shot. And as long as you have the same judge, they will remember you and they'll remember the case and they'll know what's going on, and they may not listen to you the next time. Unfortunately, though, two things happen. One is the judge can't just dismiss it because they remember the case and they think the person's lying. You still have a court hearing. You still have to show up in court. You still have to defend yourself.
Yeah.
And the second problem is, especially here, I don't know how it is in your country and in England, but there's a huge turnover of judges on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So just because you had a judge last month doesn't mean you're going to have the same judge this month. We have a lot of judges coming in and out of the family court, many of whom have really no experience with family law whatsoever. And they're put in these decision-making places where they just want to err on the side of caution, you know?
Yes.
A lot, and they want to protect their children, and they're just going to err on the side of caution for protection's sake. And that's where attorneys take advantage of some of these judges.
Yes.
Again, we have judges that have never been a family law attorney in their entire careers. They've been practicing law for 30, 40 years, but they've been doing civil litigation. They've been business attorneys. They've been real estate attorneys. They've been contract attorneys, have never practiced a day of family law in their lives, yet we're putting them in a position to make decisions in family law that impact families and children. And when they change hands every few months because they decide that they don't like family law or they need to move to another judge, then you're showing up with a new judge and that person has really no idea what has happened in the past.
Yes. Oh, my. Yes. I certainly see the disadvantage of judges changing. Certainly can see that. Is that because you mentioned that you got a high turnover of judges there? What are they just... What's the reason for that? That's
you know, I can't tell you the exact reason for it. I think a lot of it, you know, we don't really have an answer. There's a lot of judges that just don't want to do family law that often or for that long, and they request the changes. It's a very different area of law. It's very emotional, and it takes a very specific kind of person to be able to do it well.
Yes.
So they're not necessarily prepared for what they need to be doing. And so they request to be moved and go to other courtrooms. I think that's a big part of it. I think there's also just here in Los Angeles, we have multiple courthouses in different counties. And I think we handle more divorces in Los Angeles than we do in the rest of the country. And it's a very, very, very busy courthouse or a subsection of the courthouse just handling family law. So,
yeah.
So I think the workload is also pretty high.
Are they attracted into the family law, the judges, do you think, because there's a shortage? Are they desperately short of judges because of you mentioned the backlog? Are they sort of incentivized to come in?
I mean, I don't know of any incentive. It's not like they're getting any kind of signing bonus, but
right.
It doesn't really work that way. So I don't know what they incentivize or how that works for them.
Yeah, yeah. And just one other thing about the law in Britain and California. In this country, family court proceedings are pretty much secret. You're not allowed to mention any of the parties, and you can be criticized if you talk about your case anonymously outside of the court. Is that the same in California? Or I mean, I know America has got much more strength in its free speech.
Right.
But at the moment in England, I there's a lot of erosion of free speech. There's multiple news stories on and multiple fronts that of erosion of free. It's not just a family court here. This seemed to be happening a lot recently in this country, that free speech is being eroded. And I just wondered, I know that free speech is one of the strengths of America, so I just wondered how things were in the family courts over there.
Yeah, so we're the complete opposite. All divorce filings are entirely public. Mm. Anyone can go to the courthouse and pull documents on any case and find out anything about anyone, unless they are done privately with a private judge. But even then, it is still a public record. So the only times that certain items are confidential are when, and this is somewhat antiquated law, actually, and there's a big discussion of opening this up, but when parties have children out of wedlock, they are not married, but they still have children, those cases are kept confidential. You can't look those up.
Right.
But cases that are just straight up divorces with children or not children, their public record. So that's why even you have some celebrity divorces where they file paperwork with the courthouse, but to keep things more private, whatever's filed in the courthouse just says, there's a private agreement, just sign this, we're good. But otherwise, no, it's completely public and people can really look them up. Like even with a easy Google search, a lot of court cases come up.
Yeah. And so the parties are free to talk about the case outside of the court, are they? Or
oh, absolutely. I mean, it can't be done on there's certain levels of disparagement or certain things regarding confidentiality that might come into play.
Yeah.
There's also things where you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So, for example, if someone is getting spousal support as part of their divorce, the last thing they want to do is do something that would cause the payor spouse to lose their job, right? Because if they lose their job,
yeah,
they're not going to be paying you spousal support anymore, and it's your fault, so you're not going to be able to help yourself.
Yeah.
So certain things just need to be done with that in mind. But at the end of the day, no, everything is really open and nothing is really that confidential.
Wow, that's so different. It's very interesting to hear that. One of the areas you work on is prenups. And so we have to come on to that a little bit. They're not legally binding in this country. So, but you hear about them a lot in the States. A couple of questions to do with that. Are they ever challenged when it comes to the crunch time? You know, when push comes to shove and the divorce is happening, can a prenup be challenged? And also, do prenups cover child custody?
So prenups in California are widely used and they are valid. They are enforceable. There are times in which somebody might want to contest the prenup. But really, as long as it's done properly and you have attorneys that have executed it based on the law, they haven't included any kind of unconscionable provisions or things like that, they will be upheld. Now, that doesn't keep someone from trying to contest it anyway. Currently, there's a case going on here in the U.S. with Kevin Costner, the actor Kevin Costner.
I heard you had a weekend. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and his ex-wife is now going to try to contest the prenup. So again, it doesn't keep you from contesting it. It's just whether or not you're going to win. And most of the time, you're not, unless things are done improperly.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of what can be included in a prenup, custody and children in general, custody, child support, visitation stuff, those are not allowed to be in the prenuptial agreement. A prenuptial agreement only deals with financial issues between partners. So it deals with property division and how income will be divided and how assets will be characterized during the marriage.
Yeah.
And the way I look at it and what my practice has been really based on is looking at prenups as a premarital financial tool. And by that, I mean, when people are talking about prenuptial agreements, it's more of an insurance policy. Hey, if we get divorced, this is what I want it to look like. I despise that view of prenups. And I think that that's where prenups get a bad rap. Obviously, that's what prenups do in some part. But the beauty of prenups is the ability to rewrite California law in regard to what happens during your marriage. And it allows you and your spouse to really do marital financial planning on how you're going to grow together, how you're going to grow separately. What is your marital financial life going to look like while you're married in order to have a successful marriage? And a lot of that has to do with the discussions you have about money before you get married. I found that as a divorce attorney, there were so many people that would come into my office and have no idea what their spouse does for a living, no idea how they make their money, no idea what assets they have, no idea where the money comes from. And because they just don't have these discussions or even that They got married with certain expectations of what married life was going to look like,
yes,
and it didn't come to fruition. And it's because they didn't talk about it. They just made assumptions. Oh, my future husband is a neurosurgeon. We're going to live in this huge house in Beverly Hills. Well, no, the guy likes living in a one-bedroom apartment and doesn't want to spend any of his money, right? But you never talked about that. You just assumed that that's what your life was going to be like. And when it wasn't, now you're getting divorced. And so what I tell people is a prenup is a win-win situation.
Yes.
You have these conversations because I get people, well, it's not romantic. What if we break up? What if it causes a fight between us? And I said, well, look, when you get married, I guarantee you, you're going to be talking about money at least once a week. Mm-hmm. You're going to talk about money all the time. And talking about money before you're married not only exercises those muscles in having really important, necessary conversations, but it's also setting your expectations straight as to how you guys are going to live. What are you going to do? What is going to be shared? What's not going to be shared? Talk about those things. And if you end up on the same page, fantastic. You're way ahead of the game on this.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work out and you find that you're not right for each other, then you just don't get married. And that's a win too, right? Like the best thing you can do is not marry the wrong person.
Yeah.
And that helps you as well. So just having those conversations, talking about the prenup, talking about what your life is going to look like together is a huge benefit for a successful marriage in the future or not.
That's really interesting. Now you say like that, I never had that view of prenups. I viewed it, you know, I mean, my own experience of prenups is what I see in the movies and on American television. But now you've explained it like that, I can see, yeah, I mean, it's part of getting to know somebody. And as you say, you might be in love with somebody with a gambling problem or something, you know.
Exactly.
You need to sit down and I also, you know, if you think of a job, you're going to spend probably as much time or maybe more time in the office that you will with your spouse. And at the outset of a job, you're talking about, well, what's my expectations? What's your expectations? What am I going to get financially? And how's that all going to work? And yes, things move, but you sort things out at the beginning, so you know what the office hours are and all the parameters.
Exactly.
And this sounds very similar, and I get the sense of that. It's not you know, boxes of chocolates and champagne, but I totally get the sense of what you're saying in this sort of commonalized preparation.
And the thing is, the people, they're like, well, we don't want to turn our marriage into a business deal. We don't want to like have the law and talk about the law and this. I'm like, well, what do you think marriage is to begin with?
Yeah.
It's a contract.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, when you get married, the laws of the state govern your marriage. And that's it. You're going to do that whether you like it or not. So either you just say, well, let's let the government decide for us what is best for our marriage, or you can take the opportunity to really rewrite it and make it your own law. And that's the beauty. It's really one of the only opportunities that you have to rewrite the law to the point where it benefits you and your partner and your marriage. And you can get creative as long as it's not against public policy. And people don't understand that there's already a prenup written for you. It's California law. Like if you want to rewrite it, you can. You could, you know?
Yeah.
You already have a prenup. There's already one in place, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And I'm a big fan of that Ronald Reagan quote, the old one where he says, the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And when you say you've already got a prenup written by the government, that's enough to scare anyone into somewhere like your office to sort things out the way they mutually want to do it.
Absolutely. And people don't remember that. You know, when you're signing that marriage license and you sign that marriage certificate, you're signing up for a lot of different terms and conditions of your life. You know, I think there's an attorney here in New York. His name is James Sexton. And what he says, he's a divorce attorney. And what he says, it's like when you're downloading an app and it says, are you accepting all these terms and conditions? And we just click on it. We don't read through it. We just click on it. But what if marriage was an app? And when you click on it, they're like, in the fine print, it says everything you have, half of it is your spouse's no matter what. Well, wait a minute. Or just because you had a house before marriage, now he or she is going to start gaining an interest in that house. Well, no, I don't want that. Well, you should have read the terms and conditions, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I also do a lot of premarital financial consulting sessions where I sit down with people that are getting married and we talk about what California family law is. You're educated on what it means to get married in California. What does that mean with your current assets, your future assets? What should you expect is going to happen? What are you going to have to share? How are you supposed to plan? Like, marriage is not all rainbows and butterflies. This is a business. It's a business agreement between you and your spouse. And you have to know what that agreement says before you sign on the dotted line.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes total sense to me. Is this something do you think, I mean, I assume they don't teach this in the schools in California, but I'm of the opinion that family law should be taught in the schools. Well, and I've heard other people say this, that it should be taught worldwide because A, the children might understand what their parents are going through in divorce situations, but also they'll understand where they may be in just a few short years. You know, if we're talking about teenagers, you know, they may be getting married in a few short years, or they may be having children. And do they teach anything like this in schools over in California, or do you think they should?
I mean, I think the information you need to have, the more information you have, the better off you're going to be. But I think that they definitely don't teach it unless you go to law school and you take community property or family law courses. That's really the only time but that's why we have attorneys to educate you and have those consultations. But I mean, it would be great for people to learn, but also people don't really know how their bodies work. But that's why we have doctors, right? So that's why we're here as professionals, but it's up to people to seek out that help and that information in order to be educated and have a better understanding of what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they do say that one of the biggest causes of divorce is financial problems during the marriage. And
right. So
this idea that you've spoken about of, you know, and also I think it's actually respectful to your future partner to actually sit them down and say, well, this is where I am. This is where I'm trying to get to. This is where I've been financially. Put the cards on the table. It's being open and respectful to the other quality. And it's a sign of respect. I mean, if it's done mutually, I think I'd never really thought of it till we started, you know, speaking and you've told me about this. And it makes really great sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I you say that it's financial problems that cause marital problems. And I agree with you to some point. But I also think that it's not necessarily the financial problems. It's the miscommunication or the lack of communication about the financial problems. The same way it might be problems of sexual intimacy. People say, oh, they cheated. It's there's infidelity is a big problem. Well, no, there was probably a miscommunication or a lack of communication on needs or sexual desire, right? So it's that communication. And that goes back to what I said in the beginning, was that you have to exercise these communication muscles. You have to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. You have to be able to be at ease to talk to your partner about really uncomfortable things, about becoming just brutally honest with each other and vulnerable with each other in order to continue being married. And when you don't exercise those muscles and big things happen that will impact your life and you're just scared to even talk about it,
yeah,
it's going to move on without you and it's going to happen. And then that's where the problems arise. But if you talk about it and you plan accordingly and you work together and you've exercised those muscles, you're going to be in a much better place.
Do you find that, I mean, I heard some people say that as a society, we're going backwards a little bit because everybody's on social media. They're not talking to each other. I don't know whether that's true or not, but obviously dating these days is done a lot through apps and it's a little bit superficial and fast paced and that sort of thing. And there's obviously pluses and minuses there. But have you seen an increase in cases or bad marriages that you think might have originated from that sort of, I mean, some people get married as a result of meeting people in a more traditional way at work or socially. But do you find that there are people that you're experiencing where they just met quickly on an app and they maybe don't know how to communicate properly from the apps and they probably never did, you know?
Sure. No, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, I think with social media and people meeting through some dating apps and things like that, there's benefits to it. Obviously, there are benefits. I know many people that have met through apps and are married and are really happy, and it's a source.
Mm.
But I also think that through social media, again, people are leading a lot of superficial lives. They are only putting out what they want other people to see.
Yeah.
And they continue to do that throughout the relationship, and it causes problems because you don't see everything and you're kind of living a different life with your partner or different life on social media. And it goes back to the communication. I mean, I have no problems with it as long as it's communicated between spouses. I've had issues where I've had people come to me and like, I don't like that we're getting divorced because all she does is post bikini pictures on Instagram and she's just trying to get approval from other men and it just really upsets me. And I said, well, have you told her that? We're like, well, no, we haven't really talked about it. Well, it's like, what do you know? Or they have, and that's where she needs that approval and that person needs that kind of love from strangers, and that's something that they need to deal with, or that person needs to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
So it does come into play somewhat. I haven't seen it as much as I thought I would, but I think it definitely impacts a lot of things. I just recently had a case where it has impacted custody proceedings, where the new spouse of one of the parties is posting pictures of the child of her new spouse's child with somebody else.
Yeah.
And the mother was complaining, like, don't put my kids' photos on your social media.
Yeah.
That's my child. You should not be doing that. And they're fighting over that. And these issues never existed 15 years ago, 10 years ago, you know?
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they probably had a few pictures that they'd show their friend, maybe in their car or their handbag or whatever they carry them around. But yeah, now it's broadcast to, you know, a billion people. Yeah, so many problems from technology, but so many solutions as well. It sounds like a lot of your work is geared into or has the effect of preventing problems by making people think ahead of time and plan and discuss, and to stay out of court, really. The mediation side is preventative, and it sounds like you're really trying, or your idea is, I think you said it earlier, in fact, it's best not to get before a judge because he doesn't know the best way to resolve things often. And it's a prevention is better than cure, I guess.
Right.
Either way.
Absolutely. It is. And my prenups do include alternative dispute resolution clauses where you're required now, like with my prenups, you're required to go to mediation and meet with a mediator for at least 2 full day sessions before you start litigating to try to work things out.
Yeah.
And just that really is it. It's working on preventing the problem than curing it or fighting against it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that sounds pretty smart. It's just not. It's great to hear. You know, I wish we had prenups here and more enlightened free speech laws and just so many of the things you talked about. But unfortunately where we are in Britain, we've got some way to go to catch up. I think we've fallen behind. Just as we begin to wrap things up, what in California terms, your experience there, what do you think, do you have any suggestions or recommendations of things that could be improved where perhaps California needs to improve or perhaps things where it is doing especially well in terms of family law or marriage and prenups?
Yeah, I mean, we've touched on it in that they're taking steps towards more mediation and more settlement. And we've seen the benefits of that, but I think there could be more. I think that we hear new judge assignments opening up new courtrooms for litigation purposes, but we only have one daily settlement officer and one mediator judge to handle those daily settlement conferences. And I think that if we opened up the focus more on settlements rather than the litigation side of things, I think things would go further. At the end of the day, though, unfortunately, it's a business. And there would probably be a lot of pushback from attorneys because a lot of attorneys don't want their cases to settle. Because if it settles, it's done. But they want to keep it going. And I don't know if there's a documentary called Divorce Inc. And it really touched on a lot of really true subjects. It was kind of blown out of proportion. But a lot of what was said in that documentary is true. You have attorneys that just want to make money. And they're not really looking out for your best interests. They're not looking to help you. I mean, they're looking to help you, but they want to take the hard route because that's how they make their money. So no one is looking for the quick, easy solution here. And I think that there can be more of a focus placed on that and really pushing more for mediation as a first tool to try to work things out. And then if it doesn't, then head over to litigation. But I think that when people are getting more prenups and having these discussions, it alleviates the litigation, at least on the financial aspect of things. Yeah. And people can really focus on the important things of their marriage as well as their divorce.
Okay, that's really interesting. Divorce Inc. I haven't heard of that, but we can perhaps put a link to that in the show notes. You think that's a quite a good is it a documentary? Is it?
Yeah, it's actually called Divorce Corp.
Okay.
And I think you can rent it on Amazon. Probably it might be on Netflix. Uh-huh. Something like that.
Yeah. Just to go back to prenups, something I thought of earlier to ask was, in this country, I think we're looking at America through the filter of the movies and TV, and we see prenups as something for the rich and famous. Are prenups done more widely in society in California by sort of middle and low income people, or is it mainly for the rich?
Absolutely. No, it's not mainly for the rich at all. Because again, if you look at the prenup, not as an insurance policy, but just a planning tool, it's the same way you plan for your death and you're going to get a will or a trust. The same way you plan for any other life event, that's what it is. And there are people that just want to have those conversations and plan for their marriage. They might have family money coming in the future, family assets coming in the future. We have a lot of people that are working with tech companies that they continue to receive RSUs or shares or equity shares of the company through their employment. And that's going to be their safety net for the future. And they want to keep that for themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not only for the wealthy. It's really for anyone that really wants to plan for a successful marriage, no matter where you stand and how much money you have.
Yeah. No, it makes good sense to me. I wish we had them here. That's
a- yeah, surprise. I didn't know that didn't have prenuptial agreements there. I didn't know that.
You can make one. It's just they're not legally binding. So I guess if you ever got to divorce court, you could say, well, look, we signed this, but there's no nothing to make that binding.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a shame. But a bit like from what we've been talking about, it's a bit like driving a car without insurance. So, yeah.
Right.
Thanks very much for talking to us today, Raymond. I've really enjoyed it. And
thank you. Me too.
I hadn't realized before, but you're actually the first. I realized yesterday you're the first lawyer that we've had on the podcast, and so I really appreciate that. It's obviously family law. We should have more lawyers on, perhaps. But I really, for one reason or another, we haven't so far. But I really have found it interesting talking to you today, and what
it was
said, I found really interesting. I'm sure the listeners will as well. Where can people find out more about you? Are you on social media? Do you have a website, a YouTube channel, etc.?
Sure, of course. So my website is hekmatfamilylaw.com. You can also find me on YouTube at The Prenup Guy. Also on TikTok at The Prenup Guy, and Instagram is Hekmat Family Law.
Brilliant. Okay, well, what we'll do is we'll add those to the show notes for people to find you and read more about you. And
I appreciate it.
That's great. Well, again, thanks very much, and have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. Cheers. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.